Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the critical elections in Wisconsin that may result in a blunting of Donald Trump's momentum towards the Republican presidential nomination and give a renewed impetus for Bernie Sanders to stay in the race against Hillary Clinton. Mary Batari, the deputy director of the Center for Media and Democracy, who worked in Washington for U.S. Senator Russ Feingold and in the Wisconsin State Senate, joins us to discuss the impact of Governor Scott Walker's voter suppression efforts on voter turnout in today's primaries and what plans the Koch brothers have to prevent the political comeback of Russ Feingold, as well as ensuring that Paul Ryan becomes the Republican presidential nominee. Then, now that the spotlight from the release of the Panama Papers is shining on the hidden money of the global elite of glamorous celebrities, business moguls, and politicians, co-mingled with the dirty money stolen by dictators, criminals, and kleptocratic leaders, we will speak with Chuck Collins, the director of the Institute for Policy Studies Program on Inequality and the Common Good, the co-founder of Wealth for the Common Good and the Patriotic Millionaires. He joins us to discuss his article at The Nation, Panama Papers Expose the Hidden Wealth of the World's Super Rich. Then finally, with this massive global corruption scandal unfolding that is soon to embroil the United States, we will look into the implications of the revelations from the Panama Papers on the middle class and working American taxpayer, who in a little over a week from now will be filing taxes while the rich and famous are getting away with avoiding paying theirs. Edward Kleinbart, a professor of law at the University of Southern California's Gould School of Law, who served as chief of staff of the United States Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation, joins us. And joining us now is Mary Batari, who is the deputy director of the Center for Media and Democracy. She helped launch the Center for Media and Democracy's award-winning ALEC Exposed investigation and has spearheaded their work on the financial crisis and the painfully slow recovery. Previously, Mary worked in Washington for U.S. Senator Russ Feingold and in the Wisconsin State Senate, and before that for 10 years at the consumer group Public Citizen as a senior analyst on trade, financial services, toxic regulation, and food safety. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mary Batari.
Thanks for having me.
And what's the mood now in Madison, Wisconsin, now that you're an hour away from the polls closing, right?
We're an hour away from the polls closing, and this is what we know. We know that it's big turnout. That's all we know. So we know it's a very strong turnout. When I went to the polls this morning, fairly early in the day, there was hundreds and hundreds of people had already voted. We know that there are voting problems occurring, particularly on college campuses. Wisconsin passed a voter ID law, a sort of American Legislative Exchange Council model bill, voter ID law, in 2011. And this is the first election it's been implemented in because it's been hung up by court challenge after court challenge for many years. So I visited a whole bunch of campus polling sites this afternoon and this evening, and there are long lines for students to get a special ID, so not their regular student ID, but a special ID to vote, and that's one of the big areas of concern tonight.
And why was there ever an explanation why a student ID wasn't sufficient? I understand when they changed the voter registration laws in Texas, they struck down student IDs but allowed you to vote if you have a handgun permit.
I didn't know that. It has different, this sort of push for voter suppression from ALEC and the Koch brothers has taken a different form in state by state by state. But here in Wisconsin, it was an overwhelming turnout of students and African Americans in the city of Milwaukee that helped push Barack Obama over the line. And it was after that point that we saw a tremendous number of voter suppression measures coming out of the Wisconsin legislature, including ending Souls to the Polls, which was a traditional Sunday voting period in Milwaukee for African American voters coming out of church. And I think we've made something like 35 adjustments to Wisconsin's voting laws, and not to make it easier for folks to vote, but to make it harder. There is absolutely no doubt that the law could have been crafted to include student IDs, but it was specifically crafted to exclude student IDs. And it's students tonight that are struggling because, of course, UW students come in to Wisconsin from all over the United States.
So again, I'm speaking with Mary Batara, who's the Deputy Director of the Center for Media and Democracy. She helped launch the Center for Media and Democracy's award-winning ALEC Exposed investigation and has spearheaded their work on the financial crisis and the painfully slow recovery. And previously, she worked in Washington for U.S. Senator Russ Feingold and in the Wisconsin State Senate. So the significance, of course, of this race tonight, the cable news will be up all night pontificating and slicing and dicing, because this is a very key race for both Bernie Sanders on the Democratic side and Donald Trump on the Republican side. And one of the analyses that I was reading before we went on the air, Mary, is that Republicans in Wisconsin are happy campers because they've had a lot of wins with their favorite son, Scott Walker. So they're not the angry white voters that Donald Trump is bringing out, who are angry at the Republican Party for not delivering. Is there something to that?
There's something to what I'm starting to call the cheddar wall, okay? There is a group of hardcore Republican Republican supporters here in the state who have worked in lockstep on Governor Walker's extreme agenda, and they definitely think it's the way to go. These folks were leaning towards Marco Rubio, but when he left the race, they didn't quite know what to do. But they've decided that they're going to stop Donald Trump, for sure. And today, the Center for Media and Democracy has an article up at PR Watch that shows that the Kochs are favoring Paul Ryan for some sort of perhaps last-minute shenanigans at the Republican convention. And so it's all starting to make sense. The Republicans here want to stop Donald Trump. They want to keep his delegate numbers down so that he can't easily win a nomination. And they seem to have other plans in mind besides just electing Ted Cruz, which may in fact happen tonight here in Wisconsin, but they may have other plans in mind as well for a future last-minute nomination for Wisconsinite Speaker Paul Ryan.
But the premise that Republicans in Wisconsin are satisfied with, certainly with their state leadership and their governor, does that ring true to you?
Well, the governor's numbers are way down. His unpopularity rating is skyrocketing amongst regular voters, but for the hardcore Wisconsin primary voters, his popularity is quite high still. It's 77% last time I saw. So a lot of folks here in Wisconsin have gone to the Ted Cruz camp, not perhaps so much because they love the guy, but perhaps because they're interested in this idea of blocking the Trump momentum. It's very interesting politics, and we'll see what happens, because Wisconsin has an open primary. And I talked to a number of young people today in the voting lines who were interested in voting for Ted Cruz in the Wisconsin primary in order to block Donald Trump. Now, I don't know if that's going to be a huge trend, but, you know, that's the kind of mischief Wisconsinites are used to sort of making in these kinds of races.
But would they normally vote for Bernie Sanders? Are they left-wing voters?
They would normally vote for Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton.
Well, did anybody point out to them that that strategically is kind of brain dead? Because if you if you really want a Democrat to be elected president, either Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton, then you should want Donald Trump to be the Republican nominee.
But it's very, very interesting. The early sort of exit polling is showing that 60% of the voters so far, and, you know, this could be a bad poll, you never know. Sometimes it takes a while for the dust to clear. But 60% of the voters are Republican. And so it's possible that Donald Trump has drawn out a whole new group of who don't usually vote, but it's also possible that people are making mischief on the Republican side.
Well, you mean making mischief on the Democratic side?
No, Democrats making mischief on the Republican side.
That's what I mean, yeah.
Which has happened a number of times before here. But for me, an interesting issue that's showing up on both sides of the equation is the issue of trade, which has been a big player here in the Wisconsin election.
So is Wisconsin a part of the Rust Belt Rebellion?
We are part of the Rust Belt Rebellion. We have lost 68,000 manufacturing jobs to free trade deals like NAFTA, the WTO, and China over the last 2 decades. And folks remember the time when there was a little factory in almost every town. And so Trump has an appeal on that front, because even though he's not big on specifics about what he's going to do about that trade agenda, he has been consistent, actually, since NAFTA about being very dubious about these trade deals. Bernie Sanders has a really big draw as well, because he voted against NAFTA, he voted against the WTO, he voted against China PNTR. And so people know that, and even Ted Cruz has ads up talking about the fate of the working person and saying he's going to fix that and bring jobs back to America by eliminating Obamacare.
Oh, wow. And also getting rid of the IRS. Don't forget that.
And implementing a flag tax. Now, that leaves some of us sort of scratching our heads.
Right, and making the sand glow in the Middle East. No, it's quite an agenda. So let's dig in a little bit about Bernie Sanders. He's pretty close in this race, I believe, in the polls with Hillary Clinton, but it's an important win for him. What's your sense of whether he's going to make it tonight?
Well, I live in Madison, Wisconsin, which is 99.99% on the Democratic side, it seems, for Bernie. In my neighborhood, there is not a single sign for Hillary Clinton. So it's a little hard to judge the enthusiasm around the state, but everywhere he's gone, he's drawn these enormous crowds. And people say, and I've traveled with him, and people say over and over again, I like him because he's a straight shooter. I like him because his message is always the same. Now, that might seem a little bit repetitive to us reporters on the road, but there is a strong level of trust and respect for him and his career. So I wouldn't be surprised if the polling trends are correct and that Sanders wins tonight. I wouldn't be surprised if Cruz wins tonight, although I'm not sure it'll be by such a big margin that they're predicting. Trump has been barnstorming the state. This is a very strange delegate system here, and he's been barnstorming the state, trying to win delegates in each congressional district. So he's trying to, if he's going to lose here in Wisconsin, he's trying to narrow the amount of damage that's done. So it's going to be a very interesting result tonight.
And in terms of the work that you've been doing at the Center for Media and Democracy, you mentioned that the Koch brothers are wanting Paul Ryan to be the nominee, and that they'll somehow, I don't know quite how Paul Ryan will do it. Of course, he's being very coy and waiting in the wings, just as he did with the speakership in the House, and he's vociferously denying any intentions. But we've heard that before, so we have reason to be skeptical. But how is this a case of money, political heft? I mean, they've got about $1 billion war chest that they've deployed to beat Hillary. And then, of course, they didn't even think about Bernie, but still. So where does that stand? And what possible strategies could the Koch brothers have?
Well, you know, this was a story that comes out of the Huffington Post. The Huffington Post reporters Ryan Grimm and Sam Stein interviewed some Koch insiders who said this is what the chatter was amongst the Kochs. So we don't really know what they have planned, but I can tell you that Paul Ryan is a very savvy Wisconsin politician. He is aided by RNC Director Reince Priebus, who is a very savvy Wisconsinite as well. And we do have this sort of marriage between Wisconsin infrastructure, Wisconsin elite, and the Koch agenda. And that marriage has been there for a long time. The Kochs are one of the top 10 givers to Paul Ryan. He gives addresses anytime he's invited to Koch summits and these kinds of venues. And so it wouldn't be surprise me at all if there was a whole bunch of backroom gaming going on right now, where folks are trying to figure out what the heck they're going to do if the person they trust the least, Donald Trump, comes out with the nomination.
And what are the Kochs doing about stopping the political comeback of Russ Feingold?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear that.
What are the Koch brothers doing to prevent the political comeback of your former boss, Russ Feingold?
Ah, Russ. Well, we're just, it's early stages yet. So Russ is going to run against a gentleman named Ron Johnson, who you may not have heard of because he's one of the most silent U.S. senators in U.S. history, practically. And it used to be that when someone won an office like U.S. Senate, they would travel around the state. They would get in a van. They would get in a car. They'd meet with editorial boards. They would go to community events. They'd give speeches at Rotary clubs, and they'd actually meet the people of the state and ask for their votes. Well, that's not what's happening here. What's happening here is dark money group after dark money group is being registered at the FEC and other places, and they are getting prepared to completely unload on Russ Feingold. First, they're going to bump up the numbers for Ron Johnson because he's so unknown in the state, so they're running positive ads now. But at the end of the year, as we get closer to November, they are going to, unleash a whole heck of a lot of stuff on Russ Feingold, and we're going to have to see if his sort of grassrootsy style and his beat-up old van that travels all around the state is going to be able to hold them back.
Well, if our audience doesn't know Rob Johnson is, then I can remind them that when Hillary Clinton made her famous statement to the Senate inquiry into Benghazi, when she turned on the senator and said, "Senator, what difference does it make? The guys are dead, and why are you guys piling on? Do you remember that exchange?"
Yes, I do. It's one of the rare moments that Ron Johnson has spoken.
Right, right. Well, he got slapped down pretty soundly. That was his moment. And it's like Clarence Thomas speaking it before the Supreme Court. Mary, just in closing, then give us your handicapping. What do you think it'll be? It'll be Trump will lose by a narrower margin than the punditry, and that Bernie will what, just squeak by?
Well, I hate it when people ask you these kinds of things.
I know.
I do think it will be Bernie and likely Cruz in Wisconsin. Although it's fascinating to watch these sort of Trump voters who have never, ever gone to a political event or perhaps even voted before. So it's fascinating to watch them and see if they can create problems here. And so for us in Wisconsin, we haven't had a contested primary like this on both sides of the aisle in decades, if ever. And so we're very excited to be the center of the universe for one night, and we'll be watching the results with a great deal of interest.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Mary Batari.
Thanks for having us.
And again, I've been speaking with Mary Batari, who's the Deputy Director of the Center for Media and Democracy. She helped launch the Center for Media and Democracy's award-winning ALEC Exposed investigation and has spearheaded their work on the financial crisis and the painfully slow recovery. Previously, Mary worked in Washington for U.S. Senator Russ Feingold and in the Wisconsin State Senate. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into, now that the spotlight is shining on the hidden money of the global elite, we'll be looking into whether the next shoe will drop on the elite of the United States.
Wisconsin has its pleasures, pick muskies in July. Winter's nice with all that ice and snow at Christmas time. Beer and brats are tasty, but quite apart from these, there is only one thing that we love, and that is cheese. Hey, I'm a living cheesehead that you are talking to, and cheeseheads stick together like, darling, I'm with you. So if you really love me, and when you end up, please, honey, I come from Wisconsin, give me sex or give me cheese.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Chuck Collins, who's a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he directs their program on inequality and the common good, and he's also the co-founder of Wealth for the Common Good and the Patriotic Millionaires. He's the co-author of several books, including Economic Apartheid in America, A Primer on Economic Inequality, Wealth and Our Commonwealth, which he co-wrote with Bill Gates Sr., and his latest book is 99-1, How Wealth Inequality is Wrecking the World and What We Can Do About It. He has an article at The Nation, his latest article at The Nation is Panama Papers Expose the Hidden Wealth of the World's Super Rich. Welcome to Background Briefing, Chuck Collins.
Great to be with you, Ian.
And Chuck, this I find it extraordinarily ironic and rather shameful, and I'm not sure that one can shame some of the people involved, but the idea that the global elite of glamorous celebrities, business moguls, and politicians are co-mingling their money with the dirty money stolen by dictators, criminals, and kleptocratic leaders is really what seems to be coming out, at least to my mind, from these Panama Papers. So that being the phenomenon, is there a possibility that we can name and shame the global elite?
I think so. I mean, what they all have in common is they're trying to obscure their identity. And this has been happening, although with greater frequency over the last decade. As wealth concentrates in fewer and fewer billionaire hands, there's more and more use of these offshore tax havens. But I think there's also going to be a push. There already is a push globally for a series of treaties and essentially transparency agreements that means that you can't create a corporation without saying who really the beneficiary is. And I think that's one of the reforms that I think is not that far off.
So is there, short of getting reform, would it be possible to tax the top banks if they're not prepared to pony up and say who the beneficial proprietor is of the shell company, who the real owner is? My understanding is there's about $12 trillion out there in terms of the top 50 banks, and in total there's about $32 trillion of hidden money globally. So short of being able to clean it up, could you tax it?
Well, that's one proposal, is to you create essentially a two-tier national and global tax regime where the bad actors, the banks that hide identity and don't disclose beneficial owners, are then taxed at higher rates than the banks that cooperate with transparency reforms. So that could be a step toward greater disclosure. The United States, as a country, we have a lot of leverage. President Obama already, passed the Swiss Bank Reform Act, been fining a number of Swiss banks for failure to disclose, for enabling their depositors to avoid taxation. And essentially, you have to sort of go after each of these institutions in that way and hold them accountable.
And in terms of the idea I guess the difference is between the kleptocrats and the dictators and the criminals, they just want to hide their money. They don't care about taxing because it's all stolen at any rate. Whereas the global elite and the celebrities and the business moguls and the politicians, who many of whom are being named in this release of the Panama Papers, they're just concerned about hiding their money, right, and avoiding taxes.
Yeah, they're in a highly public position where it doesn't look good if they're siphoning money and moving it out of the country. So they want to do that through a secret jurisdiction that where they don't have to disclose that.
Well, that certainly was the case with the Prime Minister of Iceland, right?
That's right. A great example where he's actually apparently a shareholder of some of the banks that actually contributed to Iceland's economic collapse. So he was sort of indirectly or directly benefiting, and and it essentially brought him down, this incredible, embarrassing interview. I think we're going to see, I think this is really just the beginning. We're about to see lots of those kinds of ripples.
Well, my understanding is, I spoke yesterday with Gerard Ryle, the head of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists in Washington, D.C., who oversaw the release of these papers. And apparently there are so far the U.S. is not... it seems to be getting off scot-free, because most of the attention now in terms of investigation has gone to Britain, France, Australia, New Zealand, Austria, Sweden, and the Netherlands. But that's not to say that there's some shoes to drop here about U.S. Celebrities and prominent people hiding their money. And by the way, that law firm in Panama is the fourth largest. So you've got three bigger ones, right? So that's just the tip of the iceberg, surely.
Yeah, I think that if they don't have a lot of prominent U.S. citizens, then it is somewhat lacking in credibility. Although there might be a reason for that, which is, I think what happens is these law firms sort of do cater to certain national groups and constituencies. So Mossack Fonseca, had sort of a German Panamanian connection when it started. It may be that one of those other law firms, we do know that Panama is a huge tax haven for North American investors trying to take their wealth offshore. Panama, the Cayman Islands, at least half the North American tax dodgers are using Panama as a portal. So we know that if it's not Mossack Fonseca, it's one of those other law firms that's creating, another parallel set of hundreds of subsidiaries to mask U.S. wealth. But I think they're smart in terms of media rollout. They're going to release this in tranches and let the public absorb it. And I think we're going to see some U.S. names. I don't see how it can be a credible report if it doesn't.
Well, perhaps there is a sort of bias in the sense that the English-speaking world might want to hide their money in the former British colonies like the Cayman Islands and Bermuda, where they feel there may be some sort of a little more protection with a sort of Anglo-Saxon rectitude, if I could even suggest such a thing in the context of all of this corruption.
Although apparently a very high percentage of these subsidiaries run through the Isle of Man and run through some of the little traditionally UK protectorates. So, there's a few countries listed there where I had to kind of Google and look at the map where they are.
Right. Jersey and Guernsey, right?
And then there's the Zacelys Islands off of East Africa and the Indian Ocean. I hadn't really spent a lot of time studying that archipelago there, but apparently that and the British Virgin Islands were two of the big tax haven portals for this Panamanian law firm.
And again, I'm speaking with Chuck Collins, who's a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he directs their program on inequality and the common good, as well as he's also the co-founder of Wealth for the Common Good and the Patriotic Millionaires. And his latest book is 99 to 1, How Wealth Inequality is Wrecking the World and What We Can Do About It. And his latest article at The Nation is Panama Papers Expose the Hidden Wealth of the World's Super Rich. So one of the things that's really cruel about this, Chuck, is that when you think about, the Putins and the Poroshenkos of Ukraine and the family, the ruling family in Pakistan, and all of these other dictators and kleptocrats, along with the murderers like Assad and Gaddafi, et cetera, how all their ill-gotten gains are essentially through the help of these Panamanian law firms and the shell companies that they create, essentially end up back on Wall Street. So this is sort of a Robin Hood in reverse, isn't it?
Yeah, I actually think a lot of the actual money is banked in the United States, but it's run through these intermediaries. And this is unfortunately the story. I mean, we know that, for instance, for every dollar of aid that flows to Africa, an estimated $10 flows out through the offshore system. They're either the wealthy elites of these countries or global corporations, moving money out of those countries. So this is really the hidden wealth of the world. Within the United States, people use a lot of domestic, kind of trusts and loopholes and other mechanisms to hide wealth. So if you put together the loophole industry with the offshore tax haven industry, as you implied, we're talking, tens of trillions of dollars of wealth, really beyond the reach of accountability and transparency and taxation. And this is, for every local municipal budget that is squeezing and laying off teachers or whatever, this should be at the top of our list, reforming the system.
Well, there was a recent piece on CBS's 60 Minutes where a German actor posing as a bagman for a fictitious African minister of minerals from an African country. All of these big Wall Street law firms were only too happy to facilitate Delaware corporations, etc. And there was only one of the major law firms on Wall Street that this German actor went to with the CBS hidden camera. Only one of them said, wait a minute, this is violating the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act and I don't want to touch it. But the others were just falling all over this guy. They couldn't wait to help him out.
Yeah, and that's where I think, we need to sort of start at home here, the United States as a tax haven. Wyoming and Delaware are two states that have incredibly low requirements, low thresholds for incorporation. We need to start to put pressure across states to declare beneficial ownership. The United States has a huge responsibility and a lot of leverage to reform the system. And there is legislation pending that well, we call the FACT Coalition, which is the Financial Accountability Corporate Transparency Coalition. FACT Coalition is kind of the leading place. There's 70 groups that Institute for Policy Studies is one of them, pushing for this incorporation transparency legislation, which we go a long way, because part of what's going on here, even with this data release, is some of the beneficial owners are masked. I mean, it may indeed be, Vladimir Putin moving his money around, but his name will not appear on any of these documents. But close associates have set up shell corporations on his behalf. So some of the beneficial owners will actually never know, even with the release and leak of this information.
But I was looking at a recent piece that you posted on your website, Chuck Collins, pointing out that here in Los Angeles, we have some of the most extreme examples of inequality and a divided city between the wealthy white West Side and the much, much poorer Latino and African American eastern side of Los Angeles. And my sense is that this story is a part of this overall trend of growing income inequality. Because if the in a less than a week, or a little more than a week, I should say, working Americans and middle class Americans are going to be expected to pay their taxes on April 15th. And how do they think they feel when these rich people aren't paying their taxes and are avoiding them so successfully, and they have an entire industry supporting them?
Yeah, no, I think we should all be furious. If you think about if you're a domestic small business owner and you have to compete against a corporation that uses the offshore system, it's an extremely unlevel playing field. You have, General Electric paying an effective tax rate of 1% or 0%. You even have companies competing against each other, like Federal Express pays an effective tax rate of about 4%, where United Parcel Service pays an effective rate of like 27%. So it creates distortions and fundamental unfairnesses. But I think going back to your point, these extreme inequalities of wealth are really one of the drivers of this. As we get more billionaires, as they want to move money out of the tax reach of the tax system, they're creating trusts to pass on wealth to their children. They're parking some of those, banking and booking some of those, that wealth offshore. It's going to be beyond the reach of scrutiny and taxation for decades to come. So it's a big part of the story of this growing inequality of wealth and power in the U.S.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Chuck Collins, I wanted to touch on the Pfizer-Allergan merger, which is a massive example of corporate inversion, which has now got President Obama's attention. And Pfizer, of course, is moving to Ireland to avoid paying something like $35 million or $35 billion? I can't remember what the figure was. Enormous amount of tax that they're doing through this kind of maneuver. And this, again, gets to the very notion of you know, a kind of economic patriots and economic, what would you call them, deserters. So where does that stand? Do you think Pfizer's going to be blocked?
Well, I think that, you know, the good news is here, this is an example. The U.S. Treasury Department, President Obama went on, had a news conference today about this, specifically addressing this, and the Treasury Department handed down rules that effectively prohibit Pfizer from changing its nationality through this merger. So the whole idea of these inversions is you're a big U.S. company, and you essentially purchase a subsidiary in a tax haven country like Ireland, but you essentially kind of stage it so it looks like the little subsidiary is buying the company, and you're changing your national origins, and therefore you're changing your whole tax system. And for a company like Pfizer, where a lot of their assets are in patents on drugs and intellectual property, being based in Ireland is a blessing because they, you know, they don't tax royalties on intellectual property in the same way the United States might. So this is a good, this is very good news. It's actually probably been in the works for a couple of years. I mean, I think that the Obama administration has slowly. Been trying to make these reforms. They've effectively given up on Congress doing any kind of meaningful reform, and so they're taking executive action, as they should. So I think what this does is it sends a very powerful signal to other U.S. corporations, you know, like Apple and others that have explored or actively engaged in inversions, that, you know, this is risky behavior now. You potentially are going to run up against, you know, the Treasury Department and tax authorities. And I think that they're, you know, Pfizer's going to rethink this merger, which was entirely driven, almost entirely driven by tax avoidance.
And it was $35 billion, by the way. So
$35 billion. Yeah, the whole merger is $150 billion.
Right.
Pfizer already has a lot of assets that they have in their foreign subsidiaries, and they'd like never have to bring them back and pay taxes on them. So
sure, all they have to do is put the formula for Viagra in a vault in Switzerland somewhere, and suddenly they're a Swiss company. You know, so
they already have they already exist with the fiction that many of their patents are owned by foreign subsidiaries already.
Sure.
So this is just an extension of their strategy to reduce taxes. Already have gained a lot of that. So what happens is the U.S. parent company pays the subsidiary the royalties, which are substantial, and those subsidiaries exist in countries that don't tax royalty income.
Well, Chuck Collins, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Chuck Collins, who's a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Study, where he directs their program on inequality and the common good, as well as he's the co-founder of Wealth for the Common Good and the Patriotic Millionaires. And his latest book is 99-1, How Wealth Inequality is Wrecking the World and What We Can Do About It. And his latest article at The Nation is Panama Papers Expose the Hidden Wealth of the World's Super Rich. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back looking into how the wealthy of the world are getting away with not paying their taxes.
Give me your funny.
any paper, and in the middle of negotiations, you break down. I never give you my number. The tax man.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Edward Kleinbart, who's a professor of law at the University of Southern California's Gould School of Law. He served as the chief of staff of the U.S. Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation, and his latest book is We Are Better Than This, How Government Should Spend Our Money. Welcome to Background Briefing, Edward Kleinbart.
Thank you very much, Ian, for having me.
And Ed, what do you make of this extraordinary data dump from the Panamanian law firm, which I believe is the fourth biggest offshore shell company creator, I guess, which means that there are three other ones that are bigger than it. So this is obviously just the tip of an iceberg. But it's had enormous global repercussions, not the least of which is the Prime Minister of Iceland was forced to resign. What's your reaction to it?
It is extraordinary. I think 11.5 million documents, and so one can only imagine how many documents there would be in a similar data dump from any of the top three. What I take from this is that, in fact, tax evasion is alive and well among high net worth individuals all over the world. One of the most interesting aspects of this particular leak is that relatively few Americans are directly implicated in this leak. If you remember, tens of thousands of Americans were implicated in the Swiss bank data leaks of a few years ago. But I think Americans are uncomfortable with Panama as the base from which to organize their offshore affairs.
So there is, though, seems to be a difference in the way that the U.S. handles whistleblowers. And in this case, I mean, I'm talking about the IRS. In this case, my understanding is that this enormous amount of data that goes back 40 years, it's much bigger than the WikiLeaks data dump, was obtained by a German newspaper, but it was the German tax authorities that actually paid, and they've made it clear to whistleblowers around the world that we'll pay for any information. In the US case, I understand the IRS works out a deal with the whistleblower who gets a percentage of the money that's recouped, but it's not that easy to facilitate as it is in the case of the Germans. So is there a difference there between the way our IRS handles these whistleblower cases than the Germans, who clearly, in this case, were the recipients of this massive data dump?
Well, it appears that that there is a bit of a difference. There have been several instances where European tax authorities have just paid cash for thumb drives, and the IRS does not. The IRS has very elaborate whistleblower rules governing it, and the IRS, I think, frankly, has always been a little bit uncomfortable about the whistleblower concept. Of course, the big UBS, the Swiss bank case that sort of broke the magnitude of U.S. individual tax evasion through Swiss accounts, we did a little of everything. We ended up paying a significant amount of money to the whistleblower, and we threw him in jail for participating in the tax evasion. So we did both to the fellow at the same time.
Well, that's not exactly a great incentive to have people
no,
come
it's
forward.
Not.
So there are inquiries underway now in Britain, France, Australia, New Zealand, Austria, Sweden, and the Netherlands as a result of these leaks from Mossack Fonseca. in Panama, which is the fourth largest facilitator of offshore accounts. Senator Carl Levin suggested, when asked what can be done, said, well, one of the things we can do is make the big U.S. banks demand to know who the real person is behind these offshore accounts that are being set up. Because at the end of the day, the U.S. banks are the beneficiaries of these accounts by and large. So, and that's in essence how the money is laundered. I believe it's called what, the beneficial...
Right. Yeah, so there are a couple of issues going on here. The first is that there is a tremendous amount of wealth still held through shell companies that tries to rely on anonymity to simply hide the money from tax authorities, to hide the money from soon-to-be ex-spouses or whatever. This is dangerous and inimical to the interests of every country because it leads to tax evasion, because it facilitates money laundering, and even terrorist activity. So the idea that there should be anonymity anywhere in the world in respect of financial investments is something that needs to be worked on. Now, the United States sort of led the charge in some senses when it enacted the pioneering legislation requiring foreign banks to tell the U.S. IRS whether U.S. people held beneficial ownership, that is, not the nominee, not the name on the account, but who really owned the account, to report that from a foreign bank to the United States. And that legislation, which is known by the ugly acronym FATCA, the Foreign Account Transparency and Compliance Act, has become the model all around the world. But at the same time, the United States tries to have it both ways, because the U.S. is a problem country in two respects. First, you can incorporate a company in several states in the United States without any record of who beneficially owns that company. So ironically, U.S. incorporations can be used by foreigners to hide money. Second, U.S. banks, particularly in Florida and Texas, have received huge deposits from Latin American clients, where the United States does not cooperate with the countries in which those depositors are resident and does not provide information to those countries, even though we insist in the other direction, and in fact are quite effective at enforcing it, that the foreign banks tell us about what accounts are held by U.S. persons. So the United States does not have completely clean hands here.
Well, you'd think that the DEA would be screaming from the rafters at that situation, particularly with Florida and Texas banks taking in all of what is clearly, well, what is likely to be drug money.
Whether drug money or not, it's highly likely to be tax evasion money, and that would be the basis. But this is Congress in action. You know, this is not... because the IRS doesn't want to do it. It's because Congress is the dysfunctional organization that we know it to be, and has the United States has not signed on to the global version of the U.S. original legislation. The global push is for something called the Common Reporting Standard, which takes the very idea of the U.S. Legislation, the U.S. FATCA legislation, and applies it to everyone so as to force out anonymity in financial accounts and have financial institutions report to all countries who are the beneficial owners of the accounts at that financial institution. But the United States actually has not signed up for the Common Reporting Standard, and instead says that, you know, it will go its own way. And, you know, this is the result.
And again, I'm speaking with Edward Kleinbart. He's a professor of law at the University of Southern California's Gould School of Law. He served as chief of staff of the U.S. Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation, and his latest book is We Are Better Than This, How Government Should Spend Our Money. Well, there was, of course, not so long ago on CBS's 60 Minutes, they had a sting video where a German actor posing as a bagman for an African minister of minerals from some African country, and he went to all the big Wall Street law firms and talked about opening up some obviously shell companies and cutouts, and they were only two these big prestigious law firms on Wall Street were only too willing to help. Only one person, one lawyer said, no, this is a violation of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, and tossed the guy out of the room. But the rest of them were so unctuous, it was embarrassing. So when you have a Panamanian law firm suddenly now in the limelight as the fourth largest conduit for hiding money and laundering money, I guess, again, we have to look at ourselves, right?
Yes. As I say, the United States does not have entirely clean hands. The legislation to which I referred before was really pioneering, the FATCA legislation, in coming up with a structure under which foreign financial institutions would report the ownership by U.S. persons of financial accounts at banks or other financial institutions all over the world. And now the United States needs to step up its game and just accept the global version of that called the Common Reporting Standard, and not focus quite so much on getting low-cost deposits from Miami banks. That just cannot be in the best interests of the United States.
Well, when you've got all of these world leaders swept up in this scandal, the Argentinian leader, the family of the leader of Pakistan, and then you've got Putin, and you've got Xi Jinping's family in China. I mean, really a scandalous part is that this is a kind of Robin Hood in reverse, where you've got a lot of third world countries are being looted by their kleptocratic leaders, and the money ends up here in the first world on Wall Street. So obviously we're the beneficiaries of it, but on the other hand, we also like to distance ourselves, or at least differentiate ourselves from the Putins of this world. What's your sense of whether this could become a political issue and be used in a way to name and shame, or, as you've mentioned, our hands are dirty too, so would that compromise us?
Well, I do think that the magnitude of the Panama Papers release is going to encourage jurisdictions around the world to ratchet up their attention to squeezing out the anonymity in financial accounts through the use of nominee holdings that is the basis for all of this tax evasion. Again, the Panama Papers, frankly, would have more immediate political resonance in the United States if some big U.S. names were caught. But U.S. advisors have never felt comfortable working with Panama as opposed to law firms in some former English colonies where English is the language and where it's common law. English common law is the legal basis. So a leak from a major Cayman Islands law firm might show a lot more U.S. activity. But nonetheless, the magnitude is so large, the problem so important, not just from a point of view of tax evasion, but from getting a handle on terrorist financing and money laundering, that I would hope that the Panama Papers would lead to increased efforts around the world, including perhaps even the United States, to join the common reporting standards so that we can make some progress. In the end, there's just no excuse for anonymity in the financial markets vis-a-vis tax authorities around the world. I leave to others the ethical question of whether there's a utility to anonymity vis-a-vis one's own spouse, but that's an ethical issue I can't I can't right, handle. Well, the tax side, I'm very clear on.
Okay, well, we'll give you a pass on that one, Ed. But just in the last couple of minutes, two things that occurred to me. One is that we talked about how the IRS is not as efficient, if you will, as the Germans are in terms of dealing with whistleblowers. And all this data dump from the Panamanian law firm came as a result of the German tax authorities just simply buying these hard drives or thumb drives or whatever the means by which all this data was delivered. But here we have a situation where the Republicans continually cut the funds for the IRS, particularly the enforcement side of the IRS. And now you've got a presidential candidate, Ted Cruz, talking about abolishing the IRS. Where does that insanity come from? Because as far as I can tell, the IRS is the only government agency that actually makes money. The rest of them squander money.
Well, the IRS does make money and would, in fact, make more money if it had more resources for enforcement. There's a very big financial return to IRS enforcement activities. And I don't really have anything to say about Ted Cruz's remarks other than that they're infantile, that there is no system that both collects revenues and does not need a revenue authority to supervise the collection of those revenues. And so we will always have an internal revenue service, no matter what tax system you imagine. Just, Ian, let me close by observing that an economist up at Berkeley, Gabriel Zucman, wrote an interesting book about the magnitude of tax evasion around the world. And what he did that was very clever was he looked at the national accounts of all the countries around the world. And here are the assets of the United States. Well, who owns those assets? Here are the assets of UK. And when you add up who owns what, about 8% of the world's wealth is missing. That is, U.S. persons own U.K. businesses, U.K. persons own U.S. businesses. Each of those shows up in the national accounts that are maintained by every country. But when you add up all the national accounts, what you discover is that the assets, financial assets in the world, are about 8% larger than the official claimants of those assets, the owners of the assets. And that gives you a sense of the magnitude of the problem that we're dealing with. It's a global problem and requires world leaders to recognize that their ultimate interest lies in enforcing these rules, even if it means lower profits for some financial institutions.
Well, we have run out of time, and I did want to talk to you about the Pfizer move to Ireland, this corporate inversion that's got the attention now of the White House. But we can we'll do a follow-up on that, and I thank you very much for joining us today, Edward Kleinbart.
Ian, thanks very much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Edward Kleinbart. He's a professor of law at the University of Southern California's Gould School of Law. He served as the chief of staff of the U.S. Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation, and his latest book is We Are Better Than This, How Government Should Spend Our Money. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. One man is telling stories to me about the places he had been to and the things that he had seen. A quiet voice singing something to me, an angel song about the home of the brave and the land here on the free. One time, one night. Bye.